Thanks for tuning into this episode of PageCast, presented by Jonathan Ball Publishers. Today's episode is an incredibly special one, as the Mayor of Cape Town, Jordan Hill Lewis, is in conversation with South African award-winning documentary filmmaker, naturalist, and founder of the Sea Change Project, Craig Foster. Craig's latest book, Amphibious Soul, Finding the Wild in a Tame World, is a thrilling memoir of a life spent exploring the most incredible places on Earth, from the Great African Sea Forest to the crocodile lairs of the Okavango Delta. Craig reveals how we can attend to the earthly beauty around us and deepen our love for all living things, whether we make our homes in the country, the city, or anywhere in between. Enjoy.
Hello, everyone. I'm Jordan Hill Lewis, the mayor of Cape Town, and I'm here with Craig Foster, who's the author of Amphibious Soul, Finding the Wild in a Tame World. And Craig Foster, obviously, of my octopus teacher fame. And this is an episode of PageCast, which is the podcast run by Jonathan Ball Publishers, who is the publisher of your book, Craig. And it is lovely to have you here. We're seated in the mayor's office in the Civic Center in Cape Town on the sixth floor, overlooking a magnificent Table Mountain on one of the first days in which we've seen the strange ball of light in the sky that we were wondering if it would ever return. But we've had a stormy winter, which I suspect you rather love, actually. But great to be with you, Craig.
Yeah, incredible to be here in your offices in the early morning. Thanks so much for doing this, Jordan.
No, pleasure.
Yeah, this winter has affected our diving quite negatively. There's so much fresh water, so much sediment in the water. But of course, lots of other interesting things happening as well.
I bet. Well, let's get straight into this wonderful book that you've written. And I haven't written a list of questions, Craig. I thought we'll just have a freewheeling conversation about the book. And there's a couple of things that really resonated with me and I found quite moving. And wanted to just talk about those and we'll see where the conversation goes. And first of all, this idea, and I actually use the same word as you do, this idea of a sense of wonder is something that's very important to me. And I try to foster in my own daughter. I have an eight-year-old daughter. This idea that the world is this just incredibly wonderful, magnificent place, and this truly improbable confluence of circumstances which makes the world and all that it has possible, that we should develop the sense of wonder towards that. And I love that you, in some places, use exactly that same word. Can you just tell us about that, how you approach the world and how you've developed that sense in yourself and in your family?
It's a great question. I think, wonder, or also the word awe, comes to mind. So, I mean, if you just think of us here, we're sitting here in your mayor's office overlooking the mountain. But if you sense of what has brought us here, 13.8 billion years of this incredible evolutionary process. In your and my bodies, there are molecules that were formed in the early universe and only formed then in those giant galactic explosions. They're in our bodies. They make up part of our bones. And so we literally, the product of this unbelievable unfolding. And we are also, are all these extraordinary bacteria and animals and plants that have come through the cycle. Those are our ancestors. They literally also, we've been made from them. And then, of course, the early humans, Homo erectus, whoever invented fire 500,000 years ago, we are sitting on these ancestors' shoulders. The amazing Homo sapiens who invented the first art and science just up the coast here at Blombos. They, thanks to them, we have this technology that's recording our podcast. I mean, it's when you start to think of it in that terms, it's just mind-blowing that we're here communicating in these nice, soft, comfy chairs that are also made from everything we look around here, even though it looks like, a nice, shiny office with all the technology. Everything is made from pieces of the earth. So it becomes a wondrous thing just to exist when you feel all of that.
But I think the if there is a overriding, I mean, the book is a memoir. It's much, it's very much a story of your life, which is a wonderful story. But if there is an overriding point to it, I sense the point is that we have become so disconnected from those ancestors and their relationship with this magnificent and incredible place that we live, that there's something quite sad and unhealthy about that. And you are really an advocate for reestablishing some small part of that connection. As you say now, there's in a lot that we do, there's this kind of echo to those early humans that, in a sense, we haven't lost that connection because we are still them. And in some innate way, we still have all the same skills and connection to nature, but we seem to have pushed that out of our lives. Is that the kind of main message you wanted me to take away?
I think you've put your finger exactly on it. So thanks for being so observant. For me, it's biodiversity really sits at the heart of this idea. And when I say biodiversity, I mean all the plants, animals, bacteria, all the ecosystems and how they interact.
Mm.
And what we've kind of forgotten is that this biodiversity is our life support system. The only reason you and I and the rest of the world are breathing and eating is because of all those animals and those plants, especially the small ones.
Mm.
So the ocean, you know, the phytoplankton allows us to breathe 70% of our oxygen, and it can go on and on and on. So what is happening now is that we're compromising that biodiversity, which is one of the most stupid things to do, unfortunately, because that's the fundamental of everything. So, for instance, you know, if you've got a city to run like you have, and you've obviously got an economic plan, that economic plan doesn't make any sense unless you have a biodiversity plan, because underlying everything is biodiversity. And if it drops to certain levels, then your whole economy, everything collapses.
Mm.
You know, none of the food production will happen. And unfortunately, that's where we're heading towards. So anybody who cares about the future or has children or grandchildren, ideally would be thinking, okay, how can we look after our life support system? How can we look after biodiversity and all these incredible creatures, you know, that have looked after us from the beginning? So I've recently, with Sea Change, which is our NGO, I've created this image I think you will like.
Mm.
And it's the world's boardroom. People are sitting around the table, and there's this giant Mother Nature sitting at the end of the table.
The chairman.
Exactly. Well, she's the
yeah.
majority shareholder.
That's right.
But the shareholder of all our endeavors and of our destiny. So that's what we kind of looking at, and I'm sure you'll understand that and appreciate
I do. I just want to pursue that theme for a minute longer. Obviously, I'm a government leader, and I do feel a profound sense of responsibility to try to preserve wild spaces and preserve and repair biodiversity, because I'm afraid so much of it has been damaged. But one of the wonderful points you make in the book is that it's almost never damaged beyond repair. Nature has an incredible way of winning in the end. But what can governments do more to protect wild spaces and to protect that biodiversity?
So first of all, to put in a little bit of context for South Africa, you know, I've just been on a world tour with a book, and it's terrifying. I mean, the west coast of America, Northern California, 95% of their kelp forest gone.
Wow.
The east coast from Maine to Nova Scotia, 100% of their kelp forest gone. And that's all a lot of the biodiversity. Most of it goes with that. So in the south, I went to Florida, you know, the coral reefs are going, and I can carry on. It's quite terrifying.
Mm.
Thank God in South Africa, we've still got one of the most biodiverse countries in the world. So what's incredible here, we've still got so much intact, both on the land and in the ocean, especially in the Western Cape. So in many ways, we've got one of it's the most precious substance we will ever find in our lives. All the gold, the diamonds. Well, because everything is worthless without the life support system in place. Mm-hmm. So you could have $1 billion in the bank and that collapses, it's worth nothing. And all the gold and diamonds and everything. So it's so precious. So what I think the main thing we need to do now, Jordan, is just let people know that for some weird reason, and it's not easy to figure out, is that story has not gone out. So when you do a survey and you ask people, well, what's the most threatening thing we face? Only 1-2% of people will say, well, we've got to worry about biodiversity. For some weird reason, that story is not out there. So if we can get that story into government, into the boardrooms, and I'd love to help with that, with this imagery we're creating, so that people can realize this is actually the most important thing any of us can do.
Yes, yes. Well, that's helpful. So I want to get back to this idea of this idea of this echo that we have from our ancient ancestors and their relationship with the wild, and how to reestablish it or reestablish a part of it. I doubt that most people will be able to reestablish it to the extent that you have, and I so admire what you've been able to do. But how can us ordinary folk just reestablish a little bit of that and hear that echo?
Yeah, that's such a beautiful way of describing it. So we've 300,000 years, our species has been living here, mostly in Africa. So 240,000 years, we've incubated in Africa as a species, living fully wild, very complex lives in many ways, surviving off the land, tracking. Interesting social connections and this amazing relationships with wild animals, the sort of wild kin. So how do we reestablish some of that? You literally try to connect with even just one animal in your backyard, a bird, an insect, whatever it is. Even if you live in a city, you can find something, even if it's a rodent. Get to know that one animal, or if you choose a plant, that one plant. And try to see how that animal lives. Who's its prey? Who's its predators? How does the climate affect it? And through that one animal will become your teacher of nature. Even if it's your cat, but you've got to really look carefully and write down stuff and start to understand how a wild animal, what it does, what it thinks, what it feels, and what it's doing. And as you go into that secret world of that animal, I guarantee your own psyche will change. We've had early people, wild people, had relationships with thousands of animals and plants. And their psyche was full of that incredible language, that oldest language. So all we have to do is start to reestablish that.
I think also I'm a great advocate of just spending time in wild spaces. And I think one of the great privileges that we have to live in this city in Cape Town is that we live in one of the few cities in the world where there are spaces like that right in a major city, not a small city, but a major city. I can't think of that many places in the world that have a huge national park right in the heart of the city, and where you can go kind of within half an hour of anywhere and experience the wild. It's special to grow up in a place like that. And you grew up in this, you write movingly about growing up in this place right on the rocks in False Bay, where you really had this upfront seat to the wildness of the ocean.
Yeah, I mean, we are so privileged here. You know, you go around the world and you will not find a city like Cape Town, I think, anywhere. I certainly haven't. It is incredible what you can access. I think that spending time in nature, basically what happens is it downgrades your whole nervous system. So it just softens your whole nervous system and you just feel far more relaxed. Especially in the ocean, like we had this wonderful dive. We had, I don't know how long it was, but I had such fun with you.
It was so great.
And you remember how great you felt after that. So all the dopamine from the cold and the, you know, all the other amazing brain chemicals from seeing all those animals. So it changes your body. It changes your mind being in these wild spaces and it allows you to just, it's very healthy. I mean, doctors are now in parts of the world prescribing time in nature, you know, literally writing prescriptions to people.
Wow.
Because it's better than any pharmaceuticals. So, I mean, it's, but what I'm advocating is, sure, you go for your walk, spend time in nature, but there's another whole dimension. If you just go a little deeper, and obviously I go into that in the book, that is life-changing, absolutely life-transforming.
Mm. One of the interesting points that you make is that you do not need to embrace danger to make that connection. And I think a lot of people feel like that. You have to go, you know, dive with stingrays or great whites or something. And in your case, you tell this incredible story of following this enormous monster of a crocodile into its lair underwater down a, I think it was like a 75-meter cave. And you read this thinking, this is insane. Like, who would do this? This is life-threatening. And then you make this point that you don't have to do that to experience the wild. So do you want to just say something about, maybe just build on the theme of how it can be done in the ordinary day-to-day? You don't have to go and pat a great white.
No, you're absolutely right. For me, the strange thing, when I was younger, I was really searching for this wildness. And we were, you know, part of my job and the mad passion was to go and look for these very wild things to do, not knowing that, you know, we did this crocodile dive with great whites, tiger sharks, you name it. But by far the most profound thing, strangely enough, was going back to my childhood intertidal and getting to know the little limpets and the little mollusks that lived in the rock pools. Because I could see them every day. I got to know their intimate lives, and I was literally inside this absolutely magical world. Whereas if you're diving with a crocodile or a white shark, you're not going to be able to do that too often.
Yeah.
And you don't actually get deep into nature. So there's these small little mollusks, because people would hardly notice, provide an absolutely more profound experience.
Yes.
Funny enough, yeah.
So what I loved about the dive that you and I did together was that we also dived in the intertidal, which for everyone listening is the area between low tide and high tide, basically, that fills up with water and drains away again throughout the day. And it wasn't just the cold water immersion, which you're obviously a big advocate of. That in itself was quite invigorating and left one feeling good. But the absolute richness of life. You know, I can't think of how many hundreds of times I've swum in places like that and not been aware of really anything around me, just rocks and kelp and ocean. And yet with a guide like you see the place absolutely teeming with life and fascinating life. Just incredible how much you can see just in the rock pools and in the intertidal zone. I thought that was one of the most brilliant and memorable aspects of that.
So I'm so glad you brought that up, because that's where the tracking comes in.
Yes.
So when you learn to look for these signs, some of these animals are so cryptic and so camouflaged that they're almost impossible to see, even for someone like myself who's used to it. But I'm looking for all the little signs they've left, and that points me to where they are. So it takes time. But it's not that difficult to learn that there's this other way of looking at nature. And all indigenous people knew tracking extremely well. Wild children knew this method. It's the oldest language on earth. And to relearn that language is so transformative. You got a good sense of that. You were like, oh my goodness. And I remember you stayed in the water without a wetsuit for ages because you were so fascinated and you're healthy and strong.
And well insulated.
Like me. And then, so you got a sense for that and how wondrous it is. So to learn this language is an amazing way of getting inside of nature.
So let's go on to this tracking. And I really want the listener to try and understand just how extraordinary this is, the skill that you've built up. I mean, all of us are familiar with sand trackers in the Kalahari and the incredible skill that they have. I've personally seen some trackers in the bushveld in the Kruger, and the skill that they have, they can tell you from a paw print, how big the leopard was, was it a male or a female, obviously what direction it was going, how long ago, all of that. But that is, because it's on land, it lasts for several days, even longer. You have developed the ability to track an animal underwater, where you've got tides and water, obviously, washing everything away constantly. That it is remarkable, and it's not just a kind of figment of imagination. I've seen you do it. We've all seen you do it in the documentary. It is an extraordinary. Firstly, I wanted to ask you: is your skill globally unique? Is there anyone else that you know that does underwater tracking? And secondly, how did you actually do that? I mean, it's remarkable.
So I don't know anybody. I'd love to meet an underwater tracker. I've never met someone yet, but I'm certainly scientists are doing it in their specific fields. And I've worked with one or two octopus scientists who are very good at tracking octopus, but just octopus.
Yeah.
Tracking in the bigger sense requires knowing a lot more sign of all the different animals. So it's actually, you think it's, you don't have to be particularly clever or anything. It's about persistence and about curiosity. So I had learned this tracking in the Kalahari from these incredible Sawn Bushman master trackers. And I was wondering if I could apply it in the water. So I just started diving every day. And I said, I'm going to dive for 10 years every day and let's see what happens. After about 2 or 3 years, I started seeing my first tracks. And then suddenly, oh my goodness, they were everywhere. And their little slime trails left by mollusks, their little bite marks on the kelp, their little holes that are made bored in shells. There are thousands of them everywhere that initially, of course, you're not seeing anything. But as you get to know this language, it's just everywhere. So it's an amazing feeling when I'm going in the water. I'm actually going into the past and to some degree into the future, as well as to the present, because I can see what's happened in the night. And because of these things I'm seeing, I can also predict what animals are going to do during the day, maybe even into the night.
Amazing.
So it's an incredible window, like almost a time machine into the world. And then it's also an incredible time machine into the deep past. I was just having a chat to you before we started the interview. What's amazing about winter is I like tracking the storms, and they move rocks around in the intertidal and underwater, and they make these incredible marks and shapes and drags on the other rocks. And so you can get a sense of the enormous forces. And then there are signs, these crescent shapes, impact marks made by the superstorms, and some of them are hundreds, if not thousands of years old. They're wind tracks that are thousands, if not millions of years old. So you literally, it's the language of the earth that's speaking to you. And it's so invigorating and powerful.
Just on that score, we're talking in the middle of August. Just a couple of weeks ago, the Blombos Cave was made a UNESCO World Heritage Site. You must be very pleased about that.
Yeah, absolutely excited. So exciting, yeah.
And you've put together this small museum at the Cape Point Visitor Center, which I really recommend that the listeners go to visit if you have a chance. It's a very small museum. It's basically two rooms. But it is so expertly put together, Craig, and well done to you and your team who put it together. I think it's a remarkable, fascinating museum, and it covers basically early Homo sapiens presence here on the Cape Peninsula and this kind of southern coast. And we have this very special history here. I suspect a lot of people know about this because of the coverage that the Blombos announcement has got, but just take us briefly through why this part of the world, this peninsula and the little coast up to Mossel Bay, is so important in global human history.
Fabulous. So there's, just so you know, there's one exhibition at Cape Point here in Cape Town, and there's another at De Hoop.
I haven't seen that one.
At the De Hoop collection. It's a bit bigger and slightly more complex, but similar.
I must go and see it.
And What is so incredible about this part of the world is, if you can imagine, so our species, Homo sapiens, 300,000 years old, living with fairly simple technology, stone tools, for 200,000 years, but very sophisticated life in many ways, as I described earlier. And then at about 100,000 years ago, we see this incredible increase in technology.
Mm.
And what we have here at Blombos and Klipdrift, Klaasies River, and many of the other caves along the coast here are some of probably the best examples in the world of this explosion of consciousness. So we have the oldest collection of engravings in the world. We have the oldest drawing in the world. We have the oldest chemistry kit in the world. All the chemistry and the engravings are 100,000 years old. So essentially, we've got the beginnings of symbol making.
Mm.
And that is what is interesting, and we're talking about a book. These are the first proto-books and the first proto-computers on Earth, found here on the tip of Africa 100,000 years ago. And then Homo sapiens takes this technology, including the bow and arrow, which is 65,000 years, also the oldest we find here in these caves, when we migrate to the rest of the world.
Mm.
So this is the cradle of human culture. So if you had to visit anywhere in the world which most represented our species in the most profound way, you would come here. And it's incredible. And it isn't. What's interesting is the climate here was just so perfect for people to innovate.
Yeah, this is a fascinating point. This is why it happened here. It wasn't just luck. So say a bit about that. Why here?
So what's so good about Cape Town, and that's also what you'll know very well, is the climate is so moderate. You don't get, you know, a lot of freezing conditions like ice.
Hmm.
It doesn't get too hot because of the cooling effects of wind. There aren't terrible parasites. You can still drink the water. I mean, I took people the other day and I just drank out of one of the streams and they couldn't believe it. You know, in most parts of the world, you get these terrible parasites and diseases. You can't do that. So it's just this perfect place for humans to live. You've got this incredible amount of biodiversity, food from the sea, from the land. It is like an Eden. And in that Eden, you've got time to innovate. And that's why we see this incredible innovation happening here. And we find all these extraordinary things in the caves.
Very eloquently put, perfectly put. So please, everyone, go and see that exhibition down at the Cape Point Visitor Center, and another one I've just learned about now at the Hoop Nature Reserve, which I will make a point of going to see. I want to also give you a chance to express the slightly more esoteric side of the book, where your love and appreciation for wild places and nature goes beyond a kind of appreciation, and there's a kind of spiritual aspect to it for you as well. Perhaps you want to say a word or two about that.
Yeah, thanks. I think this interest has come from working with so many indigenous people. So I've spent 25 years in different parts of Africa making films with the San and with many other groups of people, the Dogon from Mali. And when you are close and, you know, living close, and at one stage I was, you know, very close to a Zulu Sangoma. She was my partner. You learn so much from indigenous people, and you realize that there's a whole other world that was not open to one growing up in Western culture. Mm. And that world at first seems strange and hard to imagine or accept. But when you spend years with that, it really has a profound influence on one.
Mm.
And I've experienced and seen things that don't easily fit into the Western logical way of seeing things. And what is so interesting now is, you know, I'm presenting at some of the work we have at the G20 in Brazil. I'm presenting at the United Nations. And when I've spoken to people there, there's a longing for this, even at that level.
Mm.
We have science is incredible in many ways, and I love science, and I work with a lot of scientists. But we've come up against a bit of a brick wall with climate change and biodiversity loss and all these things we're facing. And I think some of the questions and way forward and our way of surviving forward will come from the deep knowledge that Indigenous people have and the mystery of it as well, because a lot of it's still very mysterious to me coming from a Western background. What's so interesting is that, you know, 80% of the world's biodiversity is protected by Indigenous people, yet they only make up 5% of the world's population. So they know an enormous amount. And I think also if governments and you know, big companies can actually take these people a lot more seriously, I think that a lot of our future survival depend on these things that are sometimes appear to be of an esoteric nature, but can have a profound influence on our reality.
Mm. Mm. Again, very, very, very well put. Let's just talk about the family aspect. It is very much a memoir. You talk about your relationship with Swati, with Tom. And by the way, you tell this extraordinary story of this encounter with this Bengal tiger when you were courting Swati, and then you run the full gamut of tragedy with the loss of your house, and much more besides. Tell us a little bit about your personal life in how you try to marry your family responsibilities and being a dad and a partner with the huge commitment that you have to travel the world to talk about this passion of yours and to the discipline, the daily discipline of spending time in the wild. That must be tough to balance at times.
Yes, and I think I got that balance often quite wrong in the early days, you know, just working 18 hours a day and not nearly enough time spent with my wife Swati and my son Tom. And then I guess what happens if you spend enough time in the wild, it does improve your immune system, it improves your nervous system, and you realize, my goodness, that these people, my family, are the most precious thing in many ways, as well as that incredible biodiversity that's keeping us all alive.
Mm.
So I was very fortunate in that Swati is this extraordinary conservation journalist, and I've learned a lot about nature from her. So we spend a lot of time working and in nature together. So that's worked out very nicely.
Wonderful.
And then our son Tom, you know, I was able to take him to these amazing places. I was able to teach him how to track, how to dive. And now he's now 22, but I'm doing a film for the G20 and he's doing all the music and sound. So we work together on these things. So we've managed to kind of put our passions with all this work together. So it's quite useful because you're working, but you're also having a lot of fun doing your thing you most love. So I think that's a way I've found to integrate it. But of course, one needs time totally off from work. Try to take weekends off, which is not always successful, but we've come through it fairly well, I think.
And did you rebuild your house? You didn't mention that in the book.
Yes.
Yeah, you did.
Okay. So we are hoping to move into the new place at the end of this month.
Oh, wow. Yeah. Okay.
So it's taken 2 years to demolish. It was completely destroyed, demolish and rebuild. So it's a quite exciting time.
That is so great to hear. Yeah. Well, congratulations on that.
Yeah.
Well, thank you very much, Craig, for writing this book. It's deeply inspiring, and I feel inspired by it. I feel inspired to do more as a government leader to protect our biodiversity, and also inspired to just go and spend more time in the wild and try to connect and foster that that relationship better. So thank you very, very much for writing it, and I really hope that it does well across the globe. And if you haven't bought it already, ladies and gentlemen, please go and buy Amphibious Soul. Every home should have one. Thank you very much. And I really think if it can be boiled down to just one simple instruction from you, it's just go outside.
Yeah.
And I just love that, and we'll try to do that more.
You're a huge inspiration, Jordan. What you do in the world is a massive inspiration. I think most of Capetonians feel that. So thank you for the incredible work you do. It's really super inspiring. Thank you.
Thank you. And I have one request.
Sure.
You must take me on another dive.
I'd love to.
All right.
And we should go trekking.
It's a date. Done. In the cold. Thank you very much, Craig.
It was brilliantly done. If you're out of a job, I think it'd be a brilliant podcast.
Thanks for listening to this episode of PageCast. We love hearing from you. So if you'd like to get in touch, please contact us at pagecastpodcast@gmail.com. Until next time, keep reading and listening.